Hi, and welcome to episode 2 of the 107 Degrees podcast. My name is Erin Larkin, and once again, I'm joined here with Ethan Marsh. This episode is going to focus on the alcohol that Maura was carrying with her when she left Amherst, and conflicting reports regarding which items were recovered or not recovered from the car, as the case may be. All we seem to know for sure is that there was a box of wine in the Saturn when she crashed at the weathered barn corner. Beyond that, if you followed the case, then you may have picked up on the varying and often contradictory reports when it comes to the question of what other alcohol she had been carrying with her or that had been found in the car when she crashed. We're going to break down the various accounts and attempt to apply some logic to explain how there could come to be such varied answers to what should be a very straightforward question. We're also going to discuss the timeline of the evening, and I'm going to offer my theory for what may have precipitated such confusion about the alcohol. Just to be clear, I'm simply offering one theory that happens to be the most plausible to me given the evidence available. I'm certainly open to hearing other, better possible explanations that someone may have. And while I do want to note that we did do our best to provide as much clarity as possible, this topic can be a little bit confusing, especially if you aren't familiar with the case already. So I posted a chart on the website at the107degree.com that you may want to reference for clarification if you're listening to this on iTunes or a mobile device. As always, feel free to contact me with any questions. My Twitter handle is GorillaOntologist, that's G-R-L-A underscore ontologist, or you can always email me at g.ontologist@gmail.com. There have been 3 different accounts of what alcohol she was carrying with her when she crashed. Mm-hmm. So the family says one thing, Haverhill police say another thing, and the state police say a completely other thing, and the police... in particular, those accounts contradict each other.
Yes. So do you want to go into detail as to what specifically the discrepancies are and where the information comes from? Because, like, if you look at the Haverhill police, you know, what you have from them comes from a certain time in the investigation. Actually, what you have from all of them comes from a certain point in the investigation. And then, like, communication kind of stopped. So all you have is what they concluded when they were at a certain point in time. If people were to revisit it, maybe they would say, oh, yeah, you're right, that doesn't make sense. It actually was this one. But because everything kind of froze and no one's talking anymore, we're just stuck with this data that is old and doesn't make any sense.
Okay, so I'll read you the different accounts. Sure. And you can sort of like see how that might happen. So first, from the Whitman-Hanson Express, her sister Kathleen confirmed this. It says, Maura then stopped off at a local liquor store and bought about $40 worth of alcohol. Bailey's, Kahlua, vodka, and a box of wine, according to her sister Kathleen. Police later found a liquor store receipt in Maura's car. A police review of surveillance footage showed Maura was alone at both the ATM and the liquor store. So that's one. That's the first account. And then this is from multiple sources. The first is the Caledonian Record in July of 2004, and it's the state police lieutenant, Lieutenant Scorinza. So he says that Scorinza also said when Murray left the Amherst campus, she had with her a box of wine and bottles of vodka, Kahlua, and Bailey's Irish Cream. The box of wine, most of which had been spilled, was found in the car, but some of the other bottles were not found. So that's one account of what he said. And then he also told James Renner in 2012, she had purchased Kahlua, wine, and a 6-pack of Seagram's. The bottle of Kahlua was not there. So I think the implication being that the wine and Seagram's were there.
Right. So the other two did not mention the Seagram's, correct?
Correct. And then the third account is Haverhill Police. And this was July of 2011, also James Renner. All booze was accounted for. Vodka, Bailey's, wine. They don't specifically say the Kahlua.
So that's interesting. Now that's a kind of an informal quote. They're saying all of it was accounted for, and then they're naming some stuff, but maybe they just forgot to name everything.
That's what I sort of... thought.
Okay. Okay. You also mentioned, I'm sorry, Byron Charles says they recovered wine, vodka.
He doesn't mention the Baileys.
So, okay. So then what you have here is you got the HPD at 2 different times saying 2 different things. One is wine, vodka, Kahlua. One is vodka, Baileys, wine. So they're swapping Baileys and Kahlua in those 2 different accounts.
Yeah. And it's unclear if this was all one interaction that Renner had with Byron Charles. And this information comes from 2 different blog posts and his book. And in one of the blog posts, he just says Haverhill Police Department. He doesn't specifically say Byron Charles.
Okay.
But in another post, he specifically names him. And in the book, he specifically names him. So I think that this all occurred on the same day. There were like multiple posts, but I can't confirm that because, well, Renner won't confirm.
Right. Right. And so. Yeah. Okay. And now what does Renner think about these different accounts, or does he?
So I asked him and he...
It's not in his book. So his book contains the discrepancies, but doesn't comment on them. That is, he has the New Hampshire State Police account, which mentions the Seagrams, and the Haverhill Police account, which does not.
I'm not positive if Scorinze's account is in his book. It is definitely on his website.
Okay. All right. So he knows about it, but...
So it may or may not be in his book. But I pointed it out to him, so he's aware of the discrepancy. But he chose not to answer the question and directed me to Byron Charles, who I'm pretty sure he knew wasn't going to answer my question.
Yeah. And of course, by now it's been 13 years. So would you even trust anyone's account at this point?
No. Well, so what I asked Charles, I asked Officer Charles to confirm what had been published. It's specifically in Renner's book. And he wouldn't do that.
Okay.
So I don't think we can infer anything from that except for that he doesn't want to talk, which is understandable.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly. Yeah, which makes it, again, just going back to the New Hampshire State Police comment, where they're missing from their account. They mention that the clue is missing. They mention the wine and the Seagrams. They don't mention at all vodka or Bailey's, which is strange because the vodka and Bailey's were with the Kahlua, unless she bought more Kahlua, but that's speculation based on nothing. So... Yeah.
Zero, yeah.
All right.
And I mean, I guess I could see a situation where Haverhill could be confirming just the things that they were being asked about, or just the things that were purchased in Amherst, maybe, or that were on the receipt.
Right. Yeah.
That's definitely possible. But I guess the most interesting part of it is that Haverhill is saying that the Kahlua was there, and the state police are saying it was not. So that's a clear contradiction.
Right. Well, and there's also differences in the language, right? Because in some cases they're saying what they found in the car, and in some cases they're saying what was accounted for, which then opens up the possibility that it was accounted for in some way than finding it in the car in some cases, maybe.
Correct. So Haverhill says that everything was accounted for. All booze was accounted for.
The state police are specifically saying that the Kahlua was not accounted for, or they're saying it was missing.
Correct. They specifically said the Kahlua was not there, was missing, was purchased, and was missing.
So that's a direct contradiction right there.
Yes.
So basically, yeah, we have a big question mark here. Now, there's no like official statements anywhere, right, from the New Hampshire State Police. It's just quotes from various points in the investigation.
Yeah, most of our information comes from journalists' accounts.
So it's very possible that somewhere in New Hampshire, in the State Police Department, there's a file that has this information more clearly explained.
Well, I would hope so.
Yeah, right. Okay. How did this investigation proceed? I assume the state police at some point claimed jurisdiction and kind of took over.
Yeah, they would have had to after probably a week.
Okay.
I think, you know what, I think they came in on February 19th or February 20th. So that's about, like, you know, 11 days later.
So, yeah, then it's possible that they made further discoveries later on. We've talked about this a little bit before, which is why I come to this. Mm-hmm. The sister didn't mention the Seagrams, but she also only knew what Maura had on her when she left, correct?
Right. So she was referring to what was purchased in Amherst.
So if she purchased anything else after, she wouldn't necessarily know about it.
Right. Correct.
So you could infer, okay, maybe the Seagrams was purchased later.
Yeah. And the reason that's interesting is because there was an eyewitness account right after her crash at a liquor store called Butson's, maybe like 5 miles away from where she crashed in the center of town in Woodsville. Okay. And I'll find the quote. The cashier there said, quoted, "As I recall, the blue wine coolers, because that's what I drank," in reference to presumably a question about what she purchased.
Right, so she remembered seeing Maura.
Yeah, she remembered that it was what she drank. So I think that's why it stuck in her head.
Where did her account come from? Why was she even part of the case? Like, how did they find her? Did she respond to, like, an open question for witnesses, or do we know?
I think that the story had been running on local TV and in the newspapers. Okay. In fact, I'm sure it was. And she, according to, again, James Renner, reported it to her supervisor, and just never said anything about it other than that publicly.
Okay.
Until years and years later, and I think that she again came forward. But James Renner confirmed it with the family spokesperson, Moore's aunt, Helena Dwyer Murray, who confirmed that there was this witness in 2004, and they knew about
it. Okay. What did Renner think of that? You know, to him, was there any significance to that, or was he just reporting it as a fact?
So his take on it, I believe, the woman also said that she saw two other women with Maura.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. And so he assumes that it was, I think what he believes is that it was a woman named Kate Markopoulos and a woman named Sarah Alfieri, which are two of Maura's friends that she had been with the weekend before she disappeared.
Okay.
Kate was my big sister on the track team, UMass track team. See, I don't buy this line of thought at all because he says that she disappeared in that week, and that's just blatantly false. I remember her being there very specifically, but besides that point, she competed the weekend before she disappeared, which was on a Saturday, and she competed the following either Friday or Saturday, and there are records of that, of her being present. And if you don't show up to practice, you don't compete. She didn't disappear.
Right. She was at practice. She competed before and after. She had to go to practice in between. Okay. Interesting. Okay. So Renner has this theory that there's other people there. We probably don't want to get into that right now because that's a whole rabbit hole.
Right.
But, okay. So there you have an eyewitness saying that she actually saw Maura in the town buying liquor.
Blue. Specifically blue.
Okay. So that tends to confirm that there was probably Seagram's or wine coolers of some kind purchased after. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So just a quick recap. So her family says that she was carrying Kahlua, Bailey's, vodka, and a box of red wine. Haverhill police essentially say the same thing, or that's what they say was accounted for.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's the state police's account where we start to see come into conflict.
Mm-hmm.
Because they say that the Kahlua was missing, but the red wine and the Seagram's was there.
Yeah, and so you're saying that really nobody has brought this up as a, like, interesting, notable fact in the case?
Yeah, and I mean, it is hard to follow, and it's hard to sort of...
Sure.
I had to create a chart of what Haverhill police had said and what the state police had said, and so it's easy to conflate right. The two.
And when they say, like, oh, there was wine coolers, or there was Seagram's, or mm-hmm. there was Bailey's or Kahlua, I mean, you get Bailey's. Oh, maybe someone said Bailey's, they meant Kahlua, they're both, you know, liqueurs right. or something, but... you know, these are people who are supposedly reporting, like, what they saw or what was on a receipt. So, like, it really shouldn't mm-hmm. be open to interpretation.
Right. Especially the Seagram's.
Yeah, that's totally different than all the other items. It's not a bottle.
Yeah.
It's an actual pack of stuff.
And it happens to correspond exactly with what the witness at Butson's said. And I don't know if that's been connected either.
Right. So what do you make of all this? Or is there anything even to make? Or is it just incomprehensible?
I mean, it's sort of incomprehensible. But to the extent that I could come up with a reason for why they would have two different accounts, like if we're going to assume that they're not lying.
Mm-hmm. Which we try to assume as much as possible.
Yeah, at least in this particular case.
There's not a lot of incentive to lie.
Right. Especially with something that seems to be an empirical question that can be right. fact-checked pretty
yes.
easily. There's
right.
no impression that's being given here, necessarily.
Sure.
The way that you can reconcile the different accounts, the way that they're all telling the truth, could be if they're answering two or three different questions. So what you said at the beginning was something to the effect of when the reports came out and why they might make sense at the time, but then later on they could come into more information and then it might not make sense anymore. So if you look at the accounts, it actually looks like they're saying the same thing early on. State police, Haverhill, and her family are all saying the same thing. It's the wine, vodka, Bailey's, Kahlua.
Yes.
It's the state police that afterwards start changing their answer to that. And I think what could be happening is they're actually answering two different questions. In one case, early on, they're asking what she left Amherst with. And later, they're asking what was found in the car.
Right.
So I think, like, that could explain the discrepancy.
Yeah.
If they're actually answering two or possibly three different questions, if you also include what was accounted for. Because then, like you said,
right.
it could be accounted for in some way other than finding it in the car.
Right, like finding it in evidence.
Yeah, so I think it's very possible that they're not lying about anything. They're just answering three different questions.
Yeah.
And we're interpreting it as one question.
Yeah, essentially, because we want to know the whole thing, but
right,
what those questions were asked at different times of different people. So yeah.
Mm-hmm. So to me, that makes the most sense.
Yeah, definitely. If the conclusion is that there's no necessary contradiction in the reports, that leads directly, I think, to the conclusion that she did purchase Seagram's along the way.
Right.
I mean, you would then say, well, probably the state police would be the most accurate account.
Agreed.
You would expect, because they were the last ones to investigate. They should have had access to all of the local police department's information, plus any other information they were able to come up with.
But that's interesting. That's an interesting point, that the state police would have had access to all the police departments, not just Haverhill.
Right.
Because one theory that I have for why there could be different accounts is New Hampshire has this arcane law about crossing the border with certain amounts of alcohol. And essentially, it's illegal to import more than 3 quarts of alcohol from any state without a license.
Okay. 3 quarts is not very much. What is that? Like, it's like a handle, maybe?
Yeah. Less than a gallon.
Okay.
So if we just assume that she left Amherst with what her sister says she did. She has the vodka, Bailey's, Kahlua, and a box of wine. And just assuming that it's standard sizes for the liquor bottles, which is 750 milliliters, mm-hmm. putting together a combination of any two of those will push you over the line, will push you over 3 quarts.
Okay, wow.
So any combination of those things. If she were to get pulled over for any reason, mm-hmm. and there was a police officer that knew about this law and chose to exercise his authority.
Mm-hmm. When he would infer that she was from out of state based on her plates.
Yes. And if she couldn't prove that she bought it in state, or she just was honest if he asked.
Right, because why would you lie?
They would have been required to confiscate it under the law.
Interesting.
Everything over 3 quarts.
Okay, so that would have left her with one item if that happened.
Yeah, and a box of red wine is just under 3 quarts.
Okay.
Yeah, so if she wanted to keep as much alcohol as possible.
Right, the most sensible thing would be to go for the largest container that you have that you're allowed to keep. Well, that's one way to look at it. The other would be what was the most expensive one, mm-hmm. which I don't know what that would have been.
Yeah, probably the Bailey's or Kahlua.
I don't even know how much a box of wine costs. I know roughly on the others. Yeah. I don't think I've ever bought a box of wine, so.
The first time I ever have was for that one experiment that I did where I basically destroyed it.
The whole box?
Or tried to destroy it. Then I couldn't, so I drank it.
Oh, right. You were trying to test the theory of how it could have spilled.
Yeah.
Well, how did you do that, if I may ask? What was your methodology? Take a baseball bat to it, or?
So first, I might edit this out later, but I had a rental car and I was trying to drive like 20 miles an hour and then turn really quickly and see like what would happen.
Wow. Okay.
And like nothing happened. And I couldn't get up to a safe enough speed to make it like,
yeah,
like I wasn't going to risk my life to like prove this.
Yeah. No, there's no good way to simulate that without putting yourself right in the car in danger.
But I'm pretty sure I could have gone 20 miles more, 40 miles an hour, and it would not have changed the outcome. Like, nothing happens to it.
No, there's no way.
It doesn't matter where it is in the car. It could be on the dashboard, and it come forward, and it's still not going to get smashed.
Now, what if it was open? Like, completely open, with the lid off. It could tip and spill. I mean, that would have to be it, right? Because, like, I agree. There's no way you're going to, like, what in the car would cause it to shatter? It's like a box. It's like a foil-lined box, right? Like, it's a stiff cardboard. You know, it's not a bottle.
So I would question how it would even spill, because it's a tap.
Oh, yeah, that's right. They come with their own spout, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so you have to apply pressure in some way to the spout for it to come out. It's not just, like, a bottle that can be loose at the top.
So that basically makes no sense, that most of the wine could have been spilled. That's bizarre.
It's pretty bizarre. I don't buy it at all.
I think the wine is the one item that's mentioned in every single account.
Yes.
So then your theory is, okay, she kept the wine, perhaps the rest of the alcohol was confiscated, and that was why it was mm-hmm. not found in the car in some accounts, or accounted for in some accounts.
Yes.
So that's very interesting. I certainly think, you know, the fact that the clue was missing, that the state police said it was missing, mm-hmm. to me that supports the hypothesis that you had, that her booze could have been confiscated. Because where would it have gone? Why would it be missing?
Right.
I mean, some people might say, well, maybe she drank it in the car, but like, no.
Oh, I'm sure, yeah, there are people that say that.
That's not what you would do with Kahlua. You wouldn't like down it in the car. I guess she could have mixed it with all the vodka
Yeah, and somehow the
and
wine still managed to spill everywhere.
Yeah, there's no way. So to me, that supports the idea. Also, the fact that she bought more stuff. She went north, according to her sister, with wine, vodka, Baileys, and Kahlua. And then she stopped at a liquor store in New Hampshire to buy Seagram's. Like, what?
Yeah, it never made sense to me. Like, why was she stopping at a liquor store if she just left with all of that? But it would make sense if she somehow lost it. It was somehow confiscated.
Okay, yeah. We don't know. She didn't. Did she know anyone in New Hampshire? I mean, now this is going on to another topic entirely, but
That's right. No.
okay.
I mean, possibly, but not that we, the public, knows about.
So we have no reason to think that she would have dropped off alcohol anywhere for any reason.
There's no reason to think that. There's no reason it couldn't be possible, but the timing, we don't know exactly when she left, but it's approximately around 4:30. And it's about 2.5 hours away. So, I mean, I guess it is possible that leaves, anywhere from half an hour to 45 minutes to really an hour, I guess, like, depending on a bunch of different factors.
So do you want to talk about the timeline real quick, just because, just to get back to your hypothesis about her possibly having some of her alcohol confiscated, that would take some amount of time. So
Right.
does that make sense with the timeline that she was waylaid maybe for, I mean, how long does a police stop take where your stuff gets confiscated? Probably 15, 20 minutes, I would think at least. I've never had anything confiscated during a traffic stop, so I don't really know, but I know if I'm just pulled over for speeding, it takes like a ridiculous amount of time because they got to run your
Yeah,
information and everything.
it depends on the cop, and So Lieutenant Scrinza repeats this in multiple venues, multiple media outlets, that the latest she could have left was 4:30. So say she left at 4:30. Let me just, I'm gonna get
Yeah.
exact. Okay. So from the University of Massachusetts to Butson's, going north on 91 and getting off at exit, I believe it's, well, Route 118. It would take 2 hours and 16 minutes.
Okay. So that would put her there, if she didn't stop, that would put her there at 6:45.
Yep. Now, her gas tank was pretty
When
full
she left?
when the car was towed.
So she might have stopped for gas.
Yeah. My estimation on that was anywhere between 5 and 50, 60 miles. That's like what the range looked like for how much gas she had left in the car or had missing.
Had missing from the car. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, that would suggest she probably did stop for gas then.
Yes, she almost certainly did. Almost certainly did.
Yeah, because she should have been, what, it would have had to have been at least 100 miles, right, to from Amherst to where she ended up.
143.
Okay, so she stopped for gas, so there's 15 minutes, maybe. So that puts you at 7. And the accident was at.
The accident was at 7, approximately 7:25 or so. So the first 911 call was placed at 7:27.
Okay.
So, I mean, depending on how quickly Faith Westman jumped up to call 911, I would think it would take a minute or so.
Sure, but roughly, so you basically have roughly half an hour to play with,
Yes.
plus or minus, 5 or 10 minutes. So is that an appropriate amount of time for her to be pulled over, have her booze confiscated, and then stop at the closest liquor store and buy some stuff? And I think it is.
I think it is too.
In fact, it's almost hard to account for why it would have taken her so long to get to where she was
Yeah.
unless she was
That's a good
stopped
point.
in some way for some reason. Now maybe she stopped to eat or something. We don't really know. Okay, so they said the latest she could have left was 4:30. And why is that the case? Just so I have some understanding of how they arrived at that conclusion.
I actually don't know how they arrived at this conclusion. I think that they might have been using some backward induction.
Okay.
I think that he's just working backward from when she crashed. I don't think that there's a science to it, or at least not that we're aware of, because the state police's answers in episode 27 of Tim and Lance's podcast, they say that nobody saw her leaving UMass.
Okay.
So I don't think they know what time she left.
Yeah, certainly the latest is odd, because they could get, there was an ATM transaction, right? They could get the timestamp on that.
That was before 3:40. Do know that? They did say that.
Yeah, and you could get the time on her visit to the liquor store. You could get the time on some phone calls maybe, but how would you get a latest? Because she could have done anything after those. So the only way they could get a latest that I could think of is that they did work back based on how much time they presume she would have spent driving and doing any other activities that they know that she did. And what I find interesting about that is that, okay, so they're saying 4:30 is the latest she could have left. And her accident was at
7:25-ish.
So they're saying 3 hours. They're saying 3 hours. And that doesn't take 3 hours.
Doesn't take 3 hours, no. It takes 2.5.
Yeah, so why would they say that was the latest? I would think they would say the latest was 5, or maybe even 5:15 if she was speeding. So So how would they get 4:30?
I don't know.
Unless they had reason to believe it would have taken her longer than 2.5 hours for some reason.
Now, they could be assuming that she stopped for gas, but that doesn't take a half an hour.
No, it doesn't take a half hour. But if they knew she stopped at the liquor store...
Right. So the only thing I can think of, and I mean, there could be a lot of pieces of information that we don't have, but of the information that we do have, one of the things that the witness at Butson's said was that, I believe she said Fred Murray was in there trying to obtain a surveillance video and that they didn't have one, but they had an ATM machine in the store that did have one. So I don't know what the outcome of that was or if he ever got a video or any kind of recording of that, but
yeah,
if anyone were to be able to, it would be the police. So there could be a timestamp of some kind from the ATM machine at the liquor store, possibly.
Yeah, if they had that, they could have worked backwards. But let's assume the police were correct. You know, they stated it, so we can use it to try to glean some information. And based on the times it would take her to travel there and the time it would take her to get gas, there's some period of time that seems to be unaccounted for, or at least is difficult to account for.
At least 15 or 20 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah. And possibly more. At the very least. I would say probably more, because I don't know what was she doing between, 3:43 when she left the liquor store. Let's say it was 4 before she left. You know, how do you get to 4:30? What is she doing that half hour? You know, she hasn't left already.
I find it highly unlikely she went back to campus, because the parking there is not fun. It's a nightmare, and they're never going to make it better. Your lot, when you're a first year driver, doesn't matter what class you are, if you're a first year parker, you get put out in lot 12. It's literally a mile away
from the campus.
From the closest residential area.
Yeah.
So at least a mile.
But yeah, I agree. She, why would she go back to campus for a few minutes?
Yeah, because you'd either have to try to find a metered parking spot, which is just impossible, especially in Southwest, because there's just not that many of them. And it is, I think, literally the most densely populated area per square mile in like the world. Those towers.
Yeah. Yes, I recall. They're like gigantic. It's like being in like Manhattan. It's very weird.
Yeah. Yeah. It's these 5 giant towers. I think like 10,000 people live in, you know, a very, very small space.
It kind of reminds me almost of like a Soviet era, like planned city.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. Yes. It cements everything about it. So it's like impossible to get parking over there. So it really doesn't make sense to me that she would come back to campus, especially because everything that we know she did that day, she had accomplished by 3:43 if we put together the various pieces of information from police. Because she emailed professors. This I actually got from UMass, the Daily Collegian. She emailed professors around 1:24.
Yes, this is the much-discussed death in the family emails, right?
Yes.
Somewhere along the way in the gigantic game of telephone that is this investigation, yes.
So, I don't know how consequential it is, but I think it was a family emergency that turned into a death in the family.
I mean, it's the difference between a lie and an exaggeration.
Yeah. Actually, it's the difference between a discrete event and something extremely subjective.
Yeah.
So when you put it that way, it actually is kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Because we can disprove or prove that there was a death in the family, whereas a family emergency could be any range of things.
Yep.
So yeah, it's not unimportant. But so she emailed at least one faculty member at 1:24 p.m.
Okay.
And we know that she obviously retrieved her car, which was parked in lot 12, I assume.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that she withdrew $280 and that she purchased the alcohol. And the state police stated that she went to the ATM before 3:40 p.m.
Okay.
So it's sometime before she purchased the alcohol.
Okay. Makes sense. She probably purchased the alcohol with money she got from the ATM.
Right. Probably. And so she left the liquor store, according to the state police, at 3:43 p.m. And there's nothing else that we know she did before she left.
Yeah. And what could she do, really? I mean, she could buy more stuff, but there was no report of other stuff being found in the car.
Yeah, there weren't any other receipts or anything like that. The only thing I think is possible that she could have done between the time of 3:43 and departing the town of Amherst was stop at the DMV, because there were forms from the DMV found in her car. And they were presumably going to be filled out for the car crash that she had gotten into 2 days earlier. For some reason, they needed to fill out forms that the DMV provided. So it's possible that she stopped there
to pick up the forms.
Yeah, that's the only thing I can think of that she could have done. But that couldn't have taken more than a few minutes, because I believe that, if I recall correctly, the DMV was on the way to Route 91 in Hadley.
Okay.
Well, and the other thing is, I believe that you could also print the forms
online.
Yeah.
Probably.
So yeah, they, as far as I can tell, I don't think that they based the 4:30 on anything other than just working backwards to some extent.
Or if they had time from a ticket that she got, or from a stop by a police officer, they could work backward from.
The really interesting thing about that, and another possible theory I've been working on, is there's a police officer named Bruce McKay, who was an officer in the neighboring town of Franconia, which is just northeast of Haverhill. And for some reason, he called dispatch at 7:08 p.m. that night to get the number for Butson's Liquors, which was the place that she was last seen at.
Interesting.
And I don't have a theory for why he would have been calling.
Okay, that's just it's a strange coincidence.
Very strange, considering it's not his town.
Right.
It's completely outside his jurisdiction, about 20 miles away.
Okay,
so
that is very strange.
Why he would be calling this particular liquor store at that particular time is certainly curious.
That is very curious. Yeah, that time is, so that was, it was like 20 minutes before the 911 call. So you said it was 7:08?
Yes. Yep.
And that you got from police logs?
Yep, the Grafton County Sheriff's Office dispatch log.
All right. And I'm guessing nobody else would have noticed this. You didn't find this report anywhere. Is it something that you found?
Yes.
So I was reading an article about him that was linked from your blog.
Mm-hmm. This is probably the Boston Magazine article, the one that mentions his 300 traffic stops compared to the other officers' combined 11.
Yes. And it mentioned that McKay is on the side, he serves as like the prosecutor for small claims.
Really? I missed that. I totally missed that.
Yes. Because in New Hampshire, I guess New Hampshire's weird.
A drug-infested den, yeah. Some might say.
Yeah. They don't have state prosecutors for minor infractions. So McKay had a financial interest in charging people for every little thing, for arresting them for every little thing, because then he was charging them as a prosecutor and making money on that.
So would he make that money personally, or would the department
get it? He made that money because it was a job. He served in that function, and he would serve as his own witness. He would call himself as a witness. Yeah, I pulled this person over and this is what happened.
How?
And he was the prosecutor. Yeah.
What? I cannot believe. That is like the most blatant conflict of interest I've ever heard. I mean, I can't believe I missed that. I read that article like 6 times.
It's funny because the article kind of like glossed over that. It did mention it, but it didn't like go into it. And I'm like, wait. But that means that he's directly generating revenue for himself every time he makes an arrest. Like, I was a little surprised the article didn't make that connection, but it didn't. It doesn't spell it out. But to me, that's the clear implication.
Wow. Well, that explains the 300 to 11.
Yeah, because even a guy who's like a stickler and gets off on authority, 300 to 11 versus fellow officers, there's got to be a reason for that that's really compelling. And if you're making money, yeah, it's worth your time. It's literally worth your time to harass these people because you're literally making money on it. And you could see the people in the town not even knowing that or understanding that, you know, specific distinction.
Why would they?
Yeah. That they would just think, you know, this guy's a stickler and he's a jerk and he's just out to get us. But it's actually, it's almost like more banal than that. He's just trying to make money in a scummy way.
Right. That makes way more sense to me.
Yeah.
That's the definition of corruption. It's using a public post for private gain, an official post for private gain. That's the definition of corruption.
But he would, you could see how he could rationalize this. Well, they broke the law. The law said, you know, I never pulled people over or charged, you know, for anything that wasn't illegal. Registration stickers, speeding stuff. Most cops let people off for that. But technically, you don't have
that
to.
That is unbelievable.
Now, he might look at it as, and a lot of people might look at it as, it's like working overtime, you know, because he has to spend time prosecuting those cases. So that might also be why it doesn't really attract any suspicion, because people are like, well, if someone wants to put in that much time, extra time, prosecuting on the side, you know, that's their prerogative. But not knowing that it's like a racket, that if you have a system where you're creating the cases for yourself, you could actually make a substantial amount of money.
Wow. Well, I need to look more into that and try to figure out exactly how much money he could have made. But, I mean, it's definitely a little bit easier for me to buy that he might be the kind of person that would pull her over and try to cite her for something as dumb and arcane as the alcohol import law.
Yeah. So, just to get back, do you want to speculate, since that's all we can really do, about the reason why that officer, McKay, might have been calling the liquor store? Let's say, since we're connecting dots here, let's say that he did pull Moore over. He was the police officer that pulled Moore over. The first thing that comes to my mind is he, you know, tries to or implies that he's going to confiscate her liquor in, you know, because she's in violation of this arcane law. And then she says, oh, no, I bought it in New Hampshire. And then he says, oh, where'd you buy it? Just, you know, she's like, oh, I bought it in town. Oh, the liquor store in town here? Yeah. Okay, let me find out. And then he calls him up to see if she actually did that or not.
Which would be weirder if it was a state other than New Hampshire. It actually would sort of make sense because New Hampshire's liquor stores are operated, they're licensed by the state police. So they're a part of law enforcement, sort of.
Right, they know where all of them are. They're aware of them.
Yeah, so that's definitely a possibility. The other possibility is that, like, it would sort of make sense to me if he knew that the law existed, but didn't really know how to convert milliliters to quarts off the top of his head.
Right, because who among us does?
As most people do not, but the managers of these liquor stores are required to know these things, are required to know all the law and regulations. So I sort of wondered if maybe he was calling to ask, like, how much can I take? Like, for information, essentially.
Okay. So, in that case, he would have been calling them probably because they were the closest state liquor store or the one that he was familiar with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, maybe he just drove by.
Right. I mean, it's from the area. I assume these liquor stores are not in every town. They're, like, spaced out.
Yeah. Certainly not as close to as where we grew up. But, I mean, they're not completely desolate. It's not a completely desolate area.
No. But he was from Franconia, and it's not the liquor store that's in Franconia. But I don't know, maybe there isn't one there. Because I would think, well, why would he call that liquor store? Why not the one in his hometown, but maybe he doesn't have one in his hometown. Unless, I mean, I don't know where he's from. Is he actually from Franconia, or did he just work there?
He's from Lisbon.
Lisbon.
So, I know I say that like it means something to you, but...
Oh, Lisbon!
So, if... I'm trying to think of a way to put this. If Franconia is...
Are we going to do some geometry? Are you going to put some shapes in my head here?
Okay. Yes. I am going to put some shapes in your head. So if Franconia is, say, 3 o'clock on a clock.
Okay.
Haverhill is 8 o'clock. And Lisbon is 11 o'clock.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Are they all, you know, roughly equidistant from some central point, you're saying?
No, this is not to scale.
Well, where's the middle of my clock?
So it's not really to scale, but just in terms of like relationally where they are, like north, south, east, west. Lisbon is a little bit north, maybe like 10 miles north of where she crashed. Okay. Woodsville is directly west of where she crashed and slightly southwest of Lisbon.
Okay.
And Franconia is east of Woodsville, Haverhill, slightly north, slightly northeast.
Okay. Okay, so Lisbon's not particularly closer to Haverhill. I guess I was just trying to come up with some reason why he might associate liquor store, you know, with the Haverhill liquor store as opposed to the Franconia liquor store, if there was one. But we can't think of any reason why he would.
Now, depending on how he got to work every day, if he went south, he would go through Woodsville every day.
Okay.
So perhaps that's like his liquor store. Maybe that's where he goes.
Could be.
It's also very close to essentially the center of civilization in that particular little region. So it has a Walmart, it has like a Shaw's. I don't know if the Shaw's was there in 2004, but it's like a shopping area. And I believe it's the closest one to him.
Gotcha. Okay.
It would make sense that he would actually do his shopping there, so.
Yeah. So I would buy that as a plausible explanation as well for why he might have been calling there. Now, so we had two possible explanations. One, they're looking to check her story that she bought it there because she was trying to get away with it. The other, he was just trying to do a conversion from metric to standard. And both of those, of course, relate to Mora. There's also, of course, the possibility that is completely unrelated.
Yeah, absolutely.
It would be helpful, although probably impossible, for us to know how frequently police officers tried to call liquor stores. If that happens every day because people are always enforcing this law, then it's not strange. If it doesn't happen every day, it's a weird coincidence, I would call it.
Right. And I mean, at least in that 24-hour period, it was the only instance of an officer calling the liquor store.
Right, and that was the hour in which she was known to be in that area.
Yes.
Yeah, now, I find that pretty compelling. You know, you have the combination of that's the liquor store where she would have been near around that time, where she was seen by a witness. We have this discrepancy in the liquor that was accounted for, the possibility that some of it was missing, and that she bought more, potentially enough time. You certainly have enough time for her to have stopped and gotten alcohol, all kind of coming together with the exact time that he made the phone call to that liquor store of around the time when she would have been in that area. To me, yes. That does strongly suggest that he did pull her over or encounter her in some way.
Mm-hmm. Now, and there's one other piece of information that would be consistent with all of this, and I haven't mentioned it before because what I want to do is like really focus on hard documents and stuff. However, I don't know how credible it is, but there's a rumor that there was an accident earlier that night around between 7 and 7:05 p.m. I believe there are two note takers said this. One of them because she was expecting a friend to be coming and was concerned that it might be her friend. And I don't know much about the other one, but I believe it was two people that said that they heard a call that a woman went off the road on Swiftwater Road, which is right near Butson's, and that there were police and fire toned out and then called back.
Interesting.
Police canceled the call and the woman left in her personal vehicle.
So she went off the road, but there was no problem. Maybe someone reported the accident and then there was no damage. Okay.
Yeah. Now, the only reason I wouldn't find it as compelling as I do, if not for the fact that, and this is another can of worms that we shouldn't get into tonight, but that I'll just briefly mention, the damage to the Saturn was not consistent with what the police have said. They said that she hit a tree, and there was almost no way that she went over the snowbank and hit the tree. I can show you pictures of 2 days later. There's no tire marks. There's no tree bark on her car. There's just nothing that would be consistent with her hitting a tree.
Right. The trees are pretty far back from the road, as I recall there. Like, at least, like, a car length. Like, she would have to, like, bounce off the tree and, like, fly back.
She would have, like, flipped her car. It just doesn't make any sense. Also, in the police dispatch log, it says, Faith Westman says that she went into a ditch. But in the police report, he says that he responded to a call of a woman crashing into trees. That's just a blatant contradiction. Unless we're missing some dispatch logs, which is very possible.
Yeah, possible. I mean, possible they said, she crashed into trees. Maybe someone said there were trees there because there were trees like behind the car.
Maybe.
They could looking at the car, you could see there's trees in the background. So like, oh, there's trees. She crashed into a bunch of trees. Not meaning she like literally struck a tree with her car, but she crashed in an area of trees. I mean,
I'm
maybe.
not sure I would use trees as a distinguishing landmark in New Hampshire, but maybe.
Yeah. To me, from what I've seen, there's no way she hit a tree. It's not possible.
No, and I mean, I grant that the physics of car crashes are all kinds of wild chaos that I don't understand.
Yeah.
However, the headlight wasn't broken. How do you hit a tree and damage your hood without breaking the headlight?
Yeah, now that said, she hit something hard because her car was visibly caved in a little bit.
Yeah, or something hard hit
Right.
her.
There was some object
Right, there
involved.
was a collision of some kind.
Yeah, now it could be a snowbank. I don't really know how strong snowbanks are, how able to create dents in cars they are.
Yeah,
Yeah,
I don't know
I feel
either.
like we need like an accident investigator.
Yeah. I wouldn't even feel comfortable speculating on that, but that has stuck out in my head. And the other thing is, in the dispatch logs, there's three missing calls between 6 o'clock and 8 o'clock or so. Perhaps four, but that's a different story. But there's at least three missing calls. Like, they're just not there. And now, on Tim and Lance's podcast, one of the researchers that is working with them reached out to the police to find out about those missing calls. And one of them had no data. That was around 6 o'clock. The other, they said, were merged with calls in different jurisdictions, but had nothing to do, like, one was like a domestic violence call, the other had to do with a fire in Vermont.
Merged.
Yeah, so I think what that means is if they get a 911 call from, say, Wells River, Vermont, and then another call about the same issue in Grafton County. It's the jurisdiction of Wells River, so that call gets moved, merged.
Oh, okay.
I'm pretty sure that's what that
Wow,
means.
that's confusing.
I mean, I
Because
know.
then when you're looking back at like when calls came in, it creates like a weird hole.
Yeah.
Okay.
So between, 6 o'clock and 8 o'clock, there's three of those. There's three missing calls. And the one of them has no data, which is interesting. Just no data.
That is interesting. Yeah. Are there any missing calls from any other point or just in that 2 hour time span?
So three of the four missing calls occurred within, I believe, an hour and a half of her crash. And while I would love to get into the fourth one and some weirdness surrounding that, I think it's probably a good time to wrap up this episode for tonight.